This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with this. Since you went to the bottom, I just missed. My own sweet time didn't teach what I found. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't want to be defeated.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I hope back. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. But welcome back, if you've joined us before, to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. I am your host, Shane Told, as I take you into the world of lead singers. I talk to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a professional rock and roll band. Today we have a great episode. I speak to a tremendous front woman that has done so much in such a long career, a career that keeps going. I talk to Morgan Lander of Kitty. What a band. If you're not familiar with Kitty, it was a bit of a phenomenon, I want to say, in the very early 2000s. They were kind of the first, or one of the first, I'd say, all girl bands that really was super, super, like, over the top aggressive. They didn't take any shit. Their lyrics were pretty aggressive as well. And it's really, really great to be able to catch up with Morgan, who is not an aggressive person at all. Very gentle, very kind, very sweet. Absolutely love this conversation. And I can't wait for all you guys to hear it. Before we get into that, I am on tour right now in St. Louis, Missouri. It is very cold. I don't know what's up with that St. Louis. It was like, I don't understand. Like, I'm from Canada, and I go down to your city, and somehow it gets colder? What is up with that? I don't know, but I got my parka. I'll be all right. I'm on tour with my band Silverstein, and it's a lot of fun so far. We're doing a co-headlining bill with our friends in Tonight Alive all the way from Australia. Ooh, they must be even colder. They don't know how to deal with that stuff, but it's going so well. We're going all across America. So right now, we started in Ohio, and we're going west. We're heading out to California. We're going to be going through Texas, Florida, and then up the East Coast and back into the Midwest again. So if you are an American, if you are in any of the cities we're playing, please check out the tour. Tickets are available. The link is thegetfreetour.com. Shout out to our sponsor, by the way, rockabilia.com. They are one hell of a merch company, is all I'm going to say. They have more merch items than anybody. They have over 500,000. That's right, 500,000 items. Everything is officially licensed from the band. You don't have to worry about anything coming up weird. You know what I mean? I've gotten some stuff off Amazon and eBay before that was definitely a knockoff, made in China. Put the shirt in the wash, it shrinks up to your belly button. It's a nightmare. You get screens that are fading or screens that are tilted or something. You don't have to worry about that when you use rockabilia.com. It's rockabilia.com. I want to make sure that you got that because you're going to be heading over there in a few minutes. Or maybe, yeah, you know what? You can hit pause, head over there. I don't mind. I'm sure they've got some Kitty merch. I mean, they have everything. So head over to rockabilia.com and use this promo code. It is PCLSS. And when you type that in, you're going to save 15% off your entire order. And really, it's great because they're a great company, great people. It helps out the show. You know, I always love companies in general that want to hook up podcasts, want to help out because it's a great format. But Rockabilia especially is cool just because they really are the best in the business. So head over there to rockabilia.com and use promo code PCLSS and pick up some nice, nice band merch today. Before we get into the episode with Morgan and a great, very eye-opening conversation, I want to say thank you to everybody for listening to this, for being a part of this, whether you're a casual listener and you don't listen to all of them, you just, you know, listen to once in a while, whether you listen religiously every week, maybe you are a super fan, maybe you're in the All Access Club already. If you are, shout out to my sinners, you know who you are, I love you. Or maybe you should be a member of the All Access Club. And basically, what the All Access Club is for people that one episode a week just isn't enough. So we got bonus content with non-lead singers. I talk to other lead singers. I talk to people from all different walks of music life. I do Q&A sessions every month. Every 3 months, you get some stuff sent to your house. And we just had the 1 year mark, so I was sending out some very cool looking Lead Singer Syndrome t-shirts, which you can't get anywhere. You can only get them if you're a member of the All Access Club. So it's just a great community. Me and all the sinners, we're on a Facebook group. I'm on there almost every day, if not every day, talking to everybody. We're hanging out. We're discussing music. We're talking podcasts. We're talking just about everything, and it really is a great group. So it only costs you $6 a month to get in the club, and there's different tiers working their way up, but $6 gets you in. And again, that is what keeps the wheels turning on this show, is what keeps great guests coming week after week. And so I just want you to check it out again, leadsingersyndrome.com/All Access. That's the link. And again, for as little as $6 a month, throw me a bone. And believe me, you are going to have an awesome time. If you want to get in touch with me, it's really easy. It is leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. We are also on Twitter, leadsingersyn, S-Y-N, and Instagram as well, @leadsingersyndrome. And if you don't like the Facebook page, go check it out. It's, facebook.com/leadsingersyn, S-Y-N, and we've revamped the whole thing. There's a lot more content on there. We've got Meme Mondays. We're doing Throwback Thursdays. We're doing all kinds of stuff, and again, trying to get some more discussions going on there about the show and everything, because believe me, the podcast, even though they're long, even though they're over an hour pretty much, sometimes we don't get to everything, and it really is nice to have a discussion afterwards. Anyways, let's jump in to this week's episode with Morgan Lander of Kitty. Think I'd rather cruise in by the door. Let's take you down and show you deep inside my life, my inner workings. So smelling lack of inner pride to touch upon the surface is not for what it seems. I take away my problems, but only how I drive. Hello?
Hi, Morgan.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. It's Shane calling from Lead Singer Syndrome. Very nice to have
you.
Hello.
Thank you.
And I'm just down the road from you, I think. Are you in London?
Yes, I sure
am.
Yeah,
I'm in Windsor at the moment.
Oh, awesome. What are you doing there?
well, you talk about it like London's that great, okay?
Well, yeah. I don't know, Windsor, maybe a step down, I don't know.
I think that's the general consensus, but being a sort of a new, sorry, I just dropped my phone. There we go. Being a new kind of Windsor, not resident. I don't live here technically, but I'm dating a girl that lives here.
So, oh, awesome.
So I've been hanging out in Windsor a lot, and it's really not that bad.
Yeah, well, everyone who goes to a city, you know, like for the first time, or you hear things, you're like, oh, well, I've heard it's really crappy. But once you explore a city and you sort of live in it, you sort of figure out, you know, what your thing is, and you go to places like that, right?
So
Absolutely. You can find cool stuff to do, right? Like if you like little like hideaway bars, or if you like dance clubs or whatever, you can always figure something out, right?
You got it. You're right. And it's nice here too, because you have, you know, you're right by the border. Like where she lives, I can see Detroit. Like I could probably hit Detroit with a golf ball, to be honest. I'm that close.
Awesome.
Like, I'm right on the river. So it is nice to have that too, if I want to pop over and get some cheap gas or something, you know?
Totally. Totally.
But no, it's true though. Like we have, and I know you've done, I know you have, and I have, believe me, done those kind of like, let's make some money this weekend. Like we call it the 401 circuit.
Yeah.
Where you just drive along the 401 playing like all the kind of shitty little towns. Like, now if I name them, I'm calling them shitty. Like these shithole towns. Has anyone famous said anything about a shithole country lately? But you know, like when you drop into, I don't know, like Chatham or something like that. And I don't know, because the only thing I've ever seen in Chatham is like the inside of the van and the inside of some like really, really like awful venue, you know what I mean? And that's the impression you get of a city, which is probably why you think that about Windsor.
Yeah, that is true. Well, I mean, they have the casino there. I went to the casino there and I saw a show, and that, like, that whole, like, vibe was, like, pretty cool and stuff. So, yeah, like, it's a destination, I suppose. I went.
Sure.
It's a place to go.
They have an airport, so there you go.
Stepping it up.
Yeah, they do. Well, so good to have you. So much to talk about. Like, it's really tough, you know, when, you know, I do some research and I look at your career and it's like, we got over 20 years. It starts like when you're literally a little kid.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to sort of decide where to begin, decide where to take the conversation. But I guess the best place to start is with what you guys have, you know, coming out now, which is also kind of a reflection of the last 20 years. You know, your origins, evolutions, I guess DVD, live album. It's a lot of things. So that comes out on, what is it, March 30th?
Yes, March 30th.
And what can people expect? I feel like it's been, I don't want to say secretive a little bit about what it is exactly, but there's a lot, it got to be a lot of footage.
Oh, there's tons of footage. Well, I guess the documentary, like, has its origins in an Indiegogo campaign that we started a number of years ago. So we crowdfunded the money. And we actually reached over 200% of our goal, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, so it was like 40 grand you guys got.
Yeah. I mean, 40 grand Canadian. We quickly learned that most of the industry deals in US dollars, obviously.
Yeah, that's like turns into 30 real quick.
Yeah, no, it did. So it started with the crowdfunding. You know, originally, I think around the middle of 2013, we were like, hey, our 20th anniversary is coming up. Like, wouldn't it be cool to be able to do something to sort of reflect on, you know, everything that we've done and sort of celebrate the fact that we've come this far, you know, defying all the odds or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, we sort of put that in motion. We crowdfunded the money, and we actually found a really great director in Rob McCallum, who is from London, Ontario. He was living in Las Vegas at the time, and, you know, was an American citizen and all that stuff, but he actually is originally from London. So there was a lot of cool connections there. The documentary itself was filmed over the course of a couple of years. We have updated interviews as well as we scoured our archives. We went through everything, like every like VHS that we had. Like, we had bins and bins and boxes, like suitcases just full of stuff. We kept everything. So we had to go through everything, all the archival stuff. So there's a lot of stuff that, you know, fans and people would have never seen before, like the filming of our first album, Spit. You know, there was never anything that we put out, but we did actually have a camcorder at the time.
That was 99?
That would have been the summer of 1999 that we recorded that. So, you know, there's stuff that people have never seen before. You know, behind the scenes, backstage, all of the recordings of all of the albums, live stuff as well. Tons of archival, like interviews, everything like that, as well as the updated stuff to sort of tell our story in our own words, which is really cool.
So was it, you say you guys, you know, collectively, like, so I guess it was you and Mercedes, your sister, and the other band members, whoever was at the time, you know, in the band, because I know you guys have had changes, and Rob. So it was kind of everybody going through these old videotapes, just being like, what's cool? Like, that must just be so much work. Like, I can't even imagine. And how do you decide, okay, this tape's got something cool on it. Like, do you throw it in the corner and then look at it again later? It gets so time consuming.
It really was. And to Mercedes' credit, actually, she was the one that had most of the stuff, and anything that I had, I brought over to her house. She actually sat through everything and like time coded and like marked things down. Like, basically, like you're sitting, you know, making dinner and you pop in the VHS and you're watching it. And if something funny or intriguing pops up, you know, you like, she would time code, you know, and say, this is the recording of whatever, or this is the South American tour that we did, or whatever. Yeah. And it took a very, very long time. Like, I think like a month. She was really just like hammering it, like every single day, just going through everything. For the most part, like in terms of getting, you know, this sort of off the ground. Like my sister Mercedes and I guess would be technically the executive producers. and then so we, you know, we hired Rob to sort of be the unbiased director to sort of, you know, have everyone involved in telling their story.
So is Rob older than you guys or younger than you guys, or is he like, did he grow up in London when like Kitty was taking off?
He did actually. Oddly enough, he went to school. I didn't know him. I think he might be a year older than I am.
Okay.
And I'm 36. Like I just turned 36. So
I'm also 36.
Yes. Awesome. It's a good year, right?
I think so. Are you 80? Oh, you're 81 or 82?
82.
Okay, I'm 81.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn 37
next month.
Right at
the very beginning.
We're going to talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. My birthday was on the 6th of January. So.
Oh, happy belated.
Yeah. Yeah. So Rob, I mean, he's around our age, so he would be contemporary with us.
Right.
He actually went to Sheridan with Trish Doan, who was our bass player.
Right. Sheridan College, Oakville?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh,
yeah.
That's where I grew up. Know,
yeah. To do film.
Small world.
Yeah. Isn't it strange? Like, you know, all of us musicians kind of, you know, yeah. Like, I'm sure, like, we probably know a lot of the same people and all that stuff.
Sure.
But yeah, so that was the connection there. Originally, I guess Rob had asked to use one of our songs in another documentary that he was doing about Nintendo. So he wanted to, like, I don't know, use some, like, you know, kind of more local, kind of homegrown kind of talent or whatever, I suppose. And it was easy. We just, like, we're like, yeah, sure, we can, you know, get the rights to, you know, ask the label, put it on the documentary, and that was that. But yeah, like, I mean, I don't know that he was a fan, like a super fan, but he certainly was absolutely aware.
Exactly.
Of, you know, yeah.
And that's the
that
question.
Was sort of going
it's
on.
Like for him knowing what it was like for you guys starting out being, you know, high school kids that got signed and made a record with Garth Richardson and, you know, and toured America and did all this crazy stuff at such a young age. Like, it's one thing, like, I can say, even I'm not from too far away, or somebody, you know, can hear the story and go, okay, yeah, I get it. But it's a whole nother thing to actually be in London, Ontario when that's happening and be that age. Because, you know, he must have such a different insight, which is really, really cool that you were able to get somebody, you know, to do that.
Yeah, and it's very strange how it all worked out. But yeah, it would bring an interesting perspective to it.
Sure.
But I think, you know, the whole point of doing the documentary is that everyone's idea is a very surface idea of, you know, our story. So we wanted to get a little bit further, you know, into the details and the ups and downs and that sort of thing. But yeah, it certainly was kind of strange. I mean, he was, like I said, living in Las Vegas at the time.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he was from London and he was making films, you know, in the States and whatnot. And oddly enough, he actually now lives in London, Ontario again. So everything comes full circle.
They always come back. You can never leave. Well, speaking of London, Ontario, I want to talk about your upbringing because it's super unique. You know, obviously your sister is the drummer of your band and you guys have been together, geez, like constantly throughout your whole adult life, you know, with Kitty. And what was it like, you know, I know your dad was heavily involved in your career as well. What was it like growing up, you know, in London, you know, in high school, like growing up with your sister, music around the house? Like, how did this all kind of get started with your upbringing?
Well, I will say, no, I don't come from a musical family at all. It's not like we were like the fucking Partridge Family or anything. So yeah, like my parents are not musicians at all. So I really don't know where it all, like the whole thing about, you know, wanting to play music and, you know, being musically inclined kind of was kind of out of left field. But I mean, we had a really great, stable childhood. I mean, my sister and I we fought a lot. We're only 2 years apart, so we're very close in age. And we did share some friends, but I think when I was growing up, I kind of wanted to be more independent and I was like, oh, I don't want my little sister around and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, like, I mean, we were fairly stable. Mercedes and I we were both born in Edmonton, and then moved to Brampton, Ontario, very early on, and we lived there until I think I was about 12 or 13 years old. And yeah, so we lived in Brampton. It was really cool. There was really no, like, nothing really musical kind of happening then. I was kind of, you know, into more, you know, like 90s R&B kind of music back
Color
then.
Color Me Bad, perhaps?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yes. Oh, don't even get me started. We could go there. But yeah, so I mean, like, it was fairly unassuming. And then my dad took a job in London, Ontario, and everything changed.
Oh,
it was like
the turning point. Well, the TSN turning point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Everything when you're that young, everything seems like the end of the world, right? And looking back now, it really wasn't that bad. But it's like the stability of your school and your friends and the life that you had, and everything got picked up and moved far away enough that, you know, you had to sit in a car for a couple hours to go and visit your friends. And so, it changed a lot of things, especially I think for me. Mercedes, I think, adjusted a lot better, and I did not. And from there, it kind of, you know, I felt like I my personality even changed. Like, I became more of a darker entity or something.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know. It sounds kind of strange. So yeah. So, and then I started to kind of get more into like rock music and metal, I guess, as a way to channel my anger and that sort of thing. And that's where, for me, the musical thing sort of came about.
And that's when you decided you needed to get a guitar, or how did that happen?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, originally, I started playing acoustic guitar when I was, before I had moved to London, but it was like acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was just taking lessons because, you know, that's what your parents force you to do. Like, do you want to do piano? No, like pick something else that seems interesting. And then I had stopped, and then I picked it up again once we moved to London. And this time it was more like, I want an electric guitar. I think I got one, like a $50 one at a pawn shop. That's what
cool.
my dad bought me.
Cool.
Which was super cool. Also, Mercedes around the same time was like, I want to start playing drums. She wanted to pick the drums up, and that was that. So we sort of had the basis for, you know, we could learn together.
Yeah.
And we were sort of into the same music and that sort of thing. And that's sort of where the very early beginnings of the band came from. However, at the same time, Mercedes and Fallon had met, wanted to start sort of jamming together as well. So they were sort of doing something on the side, and then her and I were as well. And eventually it just kind of, it came together.
One thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's crazy. And like with that and just having that around your house, you know, your parents must have all of a sudden just been like, okay, these girls are like really into this, and they must have been very supportive. And I'm sure, like, if it's anything like my upbringing, like every birthday present I wanted like a new pedal, or for Christmas I wanted a new amp, you know, like it was always like, for me, it got more and more like music centric in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and other things in my life sort of faded away, and I became more and more obsessed with the idea of playing music. Was that like how it became for you and Mercedes too? And at what age was it like, okay, we're taking this seriously?
Well, I don't know. We were really big dreamers. Like, from the beginning, it was like, we were talking like, when we're on tour with this band and blah, blah, blah. Like, we were mental.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like, I mean, everything that happened from the span of us starting to play, like we were around the age of 12 or 13 to the release of the album, was literally like 4 years.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't even that much time. But yeah, like we became more and more obsessed with, you know, playing in the band. We practiced every single weekend. And I think it probably helped to keep us out of trouble.
Sure.
That's for sure. And my parents were very supportive, especially my dad. He was, I don't know. I feel like in a way he wanted to support us because his father was never supportive in the fun, cool things that he wanted to do with his life.
Right.
It was very much like, oh, well, you know, like, you know, I'm in business and you need to be in business too. And my dad was like a wicked, like, race car driver, and he wanted to do that professionally and like was never really supported. So he was always like super into wanting to, you know, help us however he could. And if that meant like buying, you know, a guitar at a pawn shop or driving us around or right. that sort of thing, that's kind of, you know, how he was able to sort of live vicariously through us. 'Cause he certainly could not play. My mom on the other hand was like kind of terrified, I think.
Yeah.
She was like, yeah, she was cool about it. And my mom is like a really cool lady. But I think when it started to become something that like every weekend we were playing shows, mind you, playing shows in bars that we weren't even allowed to actually be on the floor in, right? Yeah. Like you got to hide you in the back kind of thing yeah. until you play your set. But once it became, you know, like year after year, like of like practicing, it became more and more serious. You know, we were, you know, sometimes had to miss school and that sort of thing. She really thought that she was like, you guys are nuts. Especially she would say that to my dad. Like, yeah. she was like, you're nuts because, you know, like you want to help to make this happen. Like, you know, you don't know what you're getting yourself into. Yeah. She thought that we were all kind of crazy for dreaming as big as we did.
Totally. And like in some ways, looking back, you probably were, you know.
Oh, totally.
And
totally.
That's, we but that's the thing is maniacs. Like, I've had this conversation on this podcast before. It's like a lot of people have said to do this, you have to be a little crazy.
You do.
And if you're not, it's not going to work out. You have to almost be, somebody said you have to be delusional. And it's yeah. like, and in a way they're right.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, you have to be willing to, I don't know, like bet everything, you know, yeah. in some respects, especially, you know, coming from a place of like, you know, like London, Ontario, not like a musical industry hub at all.
No.
You know, and, you know, from meager beginnings and not having a single connection, not even knowing where to start.
No.
You know, so you do have to be a little bit crazy or a lot crazy.
Your dad, you talk about your dad a lot, and I know he passed away a few years back, which must have been very difficult, but he was your, you know, your manager, and he yeah. didn't have a musical background. He didn't know anything, and he wasn't a musician himself. So he must have been learning alongside you guys learning, which it's funny now looking back. It's got to be so funny for you looking back because it's your dad, you know, and
yeah,
everyone
totally.
Looks at their parents as like, well, they know everything, or at least they're really smart. So it must have been funny looking back now and being like, well, my dad was like negotiating our deals or, you know, settling with promoters. Like he didn't know what the hell he was doing.
No, not at all.
That's
not
such
at
a
all.
Cool, kind of a cool story that isn't, you know, always really heard.
Yeah, totally. Like he was, I mean, he had a background in like finance and stuff like that. Like he worked for like Chrysler Credit and stuff like that. So he, you know, was, you know, familiar with, you know, deal negotiations and, you know, working with finances and stuff like that. But I mean, the music industry, as we all know, like none of those rules really apply.
No.
Like normal business rules get thrown out the fucking window in the music industry. Right.
Right.
So that was sort of a learning curve that we all kind of had to sort of, I guess, adjust to. And he seemed to do all right, but yeah, like it was all completely new territory. So we were all like just kind of treading water, like, wow, this is crazy.
Crazy. Yeah. Well, absolutely crazy.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, working with Garth Richardson for your first two records was pretty cool. I mean, that's the guy that made, you know, the Rage Against the Machine debut
yeah.
album. And I assume you guys went out to Vancouver to do the record?
That's no, studios. Actually, we recorded both Spit and Oracle in London.
Oh, wow.
At EMAC
okay.
Studios, yeah.
Oh, EMAC, okay, yeah. I know
yeah.
that studio. That's crazy. I didn't know that. I figured you guys went all the way out there. So the question was, how was that journey, you know, going out there to make the record? But I guess, how was it him coming here and this legendary guy working on a record with, you know, kids? How was that experience?
Okay, well, I'll preface this with... We were really naive, okay? Like, we were really young. Like, we were like, oh, cool. We're like, we're going to work with this, like, big producer. And I was like, I had no idea what he even did. Like, what albums, like, his big albums were. We had to, like, look it up, you know, on Ask Jeeves, because that's what was around on the internet back then, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, I go Ask Jeeves what albums did Garth Richardson do.
Head over to Hotbot or Meta.
Yeah.
Alta totally. Vista.
On my Internet Explorer.
That's right.
Dial up. Yeah, so like we were very naive. Like we had a lot of balls, and we really didn't know a lot about, you know, I guess the world, it seems. But yeah, so what ended up happening was we got signed to NG Records, which was a small label out of New York City. At Canadian Music Week, and we had done our demo, like, 6-song EP at EMAC a number of months before. I think that was like the March break of
okay.
that of wow. 1999. We recorded that, and
spring
then,
break for the Americans, yes, March
yeah,
break.
Yeah,
we call it March break.
Yeah, yes, March break. Yes, and. Then we decided that, okay, so we got signed, and it's like, okay, well, we actually can't put this EP out. Like, they want, like, a full-length release. And it was actually Rob Nation at EMAC who knew Garth Richardson and actually sort of helped to bring him into the fold. It was like, okay, so we already had a relationship with EMAC and all the people that, you know, Rob Nation is the owner of EMAC.
Yeah.
And, like, the people that sort of, you know, run the place or whatever, and just sort of asking around, like, what can we do? Who can we get? Who do you know that could, you know, produce or whatever? And he was like, well, I know Garth Richardson. Obviously there's a connection, you know, he is, I guess, from London, and his dad, obviously huge, record producer as well, also from London. So he sort of brought him into the fold and asked him if he wanted to, you know, check this out.
Wow.
And he actually said yes, which is like really bizarre. I don't know. Like,
right?
I don't know. I mean, we played the demos, and I guess he saw and heard something in the music and was super into it. And mind you, at that time, like, I mean, NG Records, like, very small label.
Yeah.
We didn't have any money. So he did it for points, which is really cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Well, he got something worked out there, because I know that record, you know, went gold, sold like 600,000 copies or something.
Yeah.
So it was worth his time. It was worth the nine days that you spent, I heard. 9 days.
Yeah. Yep, 9 days.
That's crazy time. That, you know, at that age, being able to make a full-length record in 9 days is, I couldn't believe it when I read that.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were some late nights. Like, I mean,
sure.
I remember, you know, the weekends were like full on, full booked. Every single, you know, hour we're there until, you know, 2 a.m. And during the week, we still did have to go to school.
Wow.
So we did, you know, like, we went to school until whatever, they let you out at 4 o'clock or whatever, and go directly into the studio and, you know, start recording, do whatever, you know, do your homework while you're, well, somebody else is doing something. You know, in the tracking room, and a lot of late nights, but we made it work.
How could you focus on school when you were doing that? Like, the producer for Rage Against the Machine is there working on your record, and you're just like, oh yeah, I gotta, you know, do this factoring or whatever in my math class. Like, that.
Right?
Just, and what were your friends like saying about you, or what were you saying to your friends? Like, it is so surreal to me thinking. I have so many questions. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. Like, it really was surreal, but like, a lot of our friends were just like, I don't know, they were pretty nonchalant about it. Like, I think, like I said, like, the whole, like, everything that was happening, we were so naive about the gravity of, like, the situation that we were in. Like, we're working with Garth Richardson, and like, we didn't even really realize, like, that he was Garth Richardson, you know? Like, we were just like a bunch of like super like crazy, wild, naive kids. Like, we were so but we were really excited. Like, watching the footage is painful. It's like, we were so excited.
Yeah.
That we were just annoying the fuck out of everyone. Like, just like bothering all of the engineers and just like, just harassing everyone and just being like, loud and mouthy and just annoying. And we must have been very, very annoying to a lot of the older people.
Looking back at that footage, it must be so funny, but it must be really funny looking back at like just the fashion choices that you've had over the years and like being like, oh my God, I remember that shirt or I remember that jacket. And like,
I remember those 60 inch bottom JNCOs, of course. Who doesn't remember those? I wish I still had them. I could go camping in them. The tent.
That's so funny. It's so true.
Oh man. Yeah. No, it was a wild, wild time, but we really had no idea of the true gravity of the situation.
So the record comes out and it exploded, you know? It did. Over MTV, all over the US. I guess having an American label was great for that. It was a lot better than signing to a Canadian label. But you came up in a time when the internet was like a very brand new thing. And I think nowadays people are a little more aware that the internet can be a very mean place. But when you were starting to get in the public eye, how difficult was that to deal with the vicious comments and stuff that you must have faced, especially being so young? And I mean, I can't imagine you had a ton of confidence, but I could be wrong.
Well, I don't know. Like that, I guess that was part of the whole deal that we were, I don't know if we were prepared for it. And I mean, like everybody that's in a band still reads their blabbermouth comments. Like I do. Like it's hilarious to me.
Right, but it's hilarious now to you.
Yeah,
but back then, when they're starting out, it's not always hilarious.
Yeah, no, and it was really different. Like I can even remember before we got signed, like we had our like kiddie like Hotmail account for like you know sending out demos, and like we would get like people making up Hotmail accounts to like threaten to kill us.
Yeah, like, fuck.
And that was like before we even got signed. Like it was like we were playing some of our shows at like, you know, like Call the Office in London, like that kind of size venues, you know, and it's not like we were, you know, a huge band or whatever, but yeah, like people were very threatened by us. So there was a lot of anger and a lot of backlash. And I do remember spending a lot of time like on message boards and stuff like that. And like I don't think anything, especially when you're that young, you know, nothing can prepare you for that kind of like anger and stuff like that. Like, I mean, like nowadays, you know, you hear about like cyberbullying and that sort of thing. And it's kind of like that, but it's like,
sure, no, it is.
Yeah, it's really I don't know, it's out of control. So yeah, like I mean, and like I can remember like reading people saying like nasty things or whatever, and like going into chat rooms and just like being anonymous and like starting to talk about the band, and somebody would be like, "I hate Kitty," and then I would just like talk to them and try to get them to change their mind.
Really?
Do you know what I mean? Oh yeah,
that's amazing.
I was all over the internet. Okay. I was all over that. But these people, they didn't know they were talking to me, and like, I don't know, like I managed to convert a few people, which is hilarious.
I love that.
I wish they knew who they were talking to, right? I'm so sneaky. But
that is
like it was like the Wild West, you know, like the very early days of the internet where like chat rooms and message boards and like people would just, and I guess people still do, like just, you know, sign up and go on there to call you a slut, and then, you know, that's it. And then 50 threads later, I don't know, it's being that young though, like it can warp your mind for sure.
Well, it seems like your mind is pretty unwarped. It seems like you got, you know, things together pretty well, and you haven't, you know, you're no worse for wear, which is good.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I mean, I imagine, you know, you at a young age with your bandmates going out on tour and experiencing that for the first time. I mean, that must have been a trip, and I mean, a lot of fun, I'm sure, but do you have any stories about some of your favorite, you know, tours you've done over the years?
Oh my
Sorry
God.
Sorry to put you on the spot. Let me ask you about
one.
Oh
no.
What about,
there's so many.
What about ICP and Coolio? That was that was one that I thought was pretty amazing.
That is wild. That was one of the most wild experiences of my life. And I can remember, I don't know why ICP wanted us so badly. Like, it seems like, you know, when they have, you know, when they do their tours, they've got like their, you know, their juggalo bands that they always take out with them. And then they always throw like one random rock band in.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really strange thing. So apparently they wanted us, like we were on ICP's radar, and that's great. And I can remember being offered the tour, and I was like, no, 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 we will not do that. And I don't know how it ended up that we got convinced otherwise, but it was a really wild experience. Like there was like the one guy on that band or on that tour, like Necro, like literally like his loadout was like unplug the iPod.
Yeah.
And at that tour we were, you know, in a van pulling a trailer, loading our own gear. It was very, very minimal, like just the band and like a couple other guys, like a driver and a sound guy.
Yeah.
And so we were like hauling all of our own gear, like loading up, and they're playing like big places, like, you know, sheds and stuff.
Yeah.
So it was crazy. But the people watching is yeah. is the best part about it, you know, like their fans are so like they're so blind to everything. They don't care. Like they accepted us. Like we would have probably done a terrible job of opening for Slayer, you know what I mean?
Right.
Everybody fucking, you know, just wants to see Slayer. But
true.
With ICP, they were actually really, really like accepting, and we were like the very sore thumb on that band or on that tour. But
right.
it was cool. Like, I mean, we did the Gathering of the Juggalos, which is their like
yeah,
weekend
sure,
festival
of course.
Thing.
Of course.
That is like That was like creatures crawling out from under rocks and shit. Like that was some shit.
I've because, always like, wanted to, you know, kind of poke my head in just to kind of see what goes on. But
yeah.
I've never taken the plunge.
It's there's no rule. So it's on private property. So there's no police. It's like they can come up to the perimeter of the area, but they can't actually go in because it's private property. So it's just anything goes. Like people are walking around naked. You can buy every kind of drug there. They have
wow.
like Juggalo court. They have cages set up. And if you go to Juggalo court, if you have a grievance with someone, they lock you in a cage. And it's crazy. And like food vendors and just like, it's like a really, really demented, like traveling circus. And the show and the music is going on all night long. Our set was at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And we played to like there like it was this I guess a second stage. There's like probably like 5 or 6 thousand people there.
That's wild. Wow.
At
no,
4 o'clock
I,
in the morning.
Heard,
and
like,
Bobby Brown played before us. Like Bobby Brown, like my prerogative, Bobby Brown.
Wow. I think that's just like them fucking with people. Like that's gotta be, I mean
yeah.
That's
well, I will say that, you know, like they were cool to us. They were very kind. They're, you know, great business people. They've really developed like the whole family thing that they have,
yep,
like within
yep.
that community is real. Like they like accept you. If you are down with a clown, then you're down for life.
Down
I
with the clown.
Guess.
There you go. Oh my God. Amazing. Well, you've had so many issues with, you know, the music industry, let's just say. With labels kind of fucking you over, you know, I've read all these stories about you guys, and my favorite thing about it is when you guys kind of said fuck it and formed your own label,
mm-hmm.
and then got sued by Kiss.
I know, right?
Gene Simmons calls like it's like okay, like that's just got to be the icing on the cake. So talk to me about that, how that's been over the years. Just it seems like there's been a lot of roadblocks and a lot of just problems, like. And I'm not really sure why, if it's because of your age or because of, you know, being a female band, you know, what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. It's really hard to say. Like, I don't know if there truly is a blacklist of the music industry, but if there is, that we probably were on it at one time. I don't know. I just think, the industry, it's a harsh place. It's not the easiest place to, you know, to thrive. Like, I mean, for every band that makes it to the 20-year mark, there
right.
are, you know, 50, 100, 200 of them that don't make it past the first couple of years or their first album.
Totally.
So I think, at least to our credit, we we are resilient, and it's been a learned resilience with everything. I mean, you know, there were many times where we wanted to sort of just like crumble and fade away, but for some reason, you know, the music was our calling, I guess. But I think a lot of it, you know, is just like victims of circumstance. I mean, originally when, you know, we signed with NG Records, they sort of amalgamated with Artemis, and Artemis Records was like a huge label with like Danny Goldberg at the head, who like managed Nirvana and like, you know, all these guys, illustrious careers. And then there was so much pressure that I just don't think that we were able to deliver the way that they wanted us to. Like, I can remember being asked after Ozfest to go back in the studio and do another album. And that was like 8 months after the first album was released. And I don't know. I think because we were so young, our parents were there to try to be the buffer against, you know, the, you know, types of abuses that could go on, you know, exhaustion, that type of thing. Sure. Like, so, I mean, and at that time, like, I think I just turned 18 and, you know, Mercedes was 16 and Fallon and Talina were like 17 years old, you know? So it's like, we were still very, very young, and maybe, you know, maybe we pissed people off. And I think it's hard to say in reflecting. I mean, we always definitely were rebellious in that we didn't like to play by the rules. You know, if somebody asked us to do something because it would be good for PR, we would be like, fuck you, that's stupid, and not do it and make somebody mad.
Right.
And so I don't know, maybe, you know, maybe that has something to do with it, but a lot of it too is just, you know, circumstance, like at Artemis Records, you know, towards the end of our relationship with Artemis, I don't think they were doing so great as a label. And for a long time we were sort of in limbo with them, and there was some legal stuff that was happening as well. So, but that was just because, again, we were like, you know, we like to stick up for ourselves, and and, you know, sometimes it can get you in trouble, you know, a lot of times.
But it also could be the reason that you guys are still here, like you kind of alluded to, you know? I mean, I mean, the fact that you played by your own rules and did what you wanted, sometimes, you know, fans have a lot of respect for that and will stick by you when you're not doing, you know, the cliche things that everyone kind of wants you to do, you know what I mean?
And I mean, playing by the rules might make you more rich or whatever, but in the end, I don't know, like, is that worth your, like, dignity or your pride or how you feel, you know?
Well, it's rare for an all-girl band to be so heavy, like, you know, like you were. Was there pressure from the labels, you know, over the years to try to, you know, get you guys to be softer or more accessible?
Yeah.
There must have been.
Yeah, of course. There was. And it's interesting that, you know, we're talking about this because, like, we didn't really touch too much on that, really, in the documentary. There's a lot of other things that we touched on, but I feel good that we're talking about this. I'm getting it all out here.
Good.
But yeah, no, there was pressure for sure. I can remember, I'm not going to name any names or anything, but like, I can remember, you know, being told, we were interviewing, I guess, people who wanted to be our manager, because the label felt like my dad, because he wasn't like an industry insider, that, you know, he wasn't going to be able to get us as far or whatever. So we talked to a lot of people and did some manager type interviews, and the guy was like, oh, we'll get you an image consultant and we'll get you a songwriter and all this stuff. And we were like, okay, well, that's not going to happen, because the whole point of being in this band and, you know, doing our thing, right? And it may not be pretty and it may not be glossy, but that's who we are, and we were pretty proud of that. So yeah, there was pressure to change our sound, or, you know, to play by those industry rules to, you know, maybe make a little more money. And of course we said no, and that's stupid, and maybe we should have, and maybe that, you know, it wasn't the right decision. But I think looking back now, we as young as we were steadfast. We held our ground. We didn't want to, you know, compromise who we were, or try to have somebody to portray us in a different way than other than exactly who we felt we were.
Oh, I think that's great. I mean, and yeah, the documentary is really cool. I love that you, you know, on the Facebook header or whatever of your page, you kind of have this big panoramic shot with like all the members of the band.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really, really cool idea. It kind of shows your legacy, but it's also sort of a nice tribute to everyone.
Yeah.
Especially a nice tribute to Trish, you know,
yeah,
passing away last year. That must have been very, very hard for you.
That was... honestly, the most devastating thing. Trish was my best friend. Like our relationship in the band, especially with the, you know, the last lineup, you know, Tara, Trish, and Mercedes, and I. Yeah. You know, I sometimes, you know, people don't understand that, you know, being in a band also is like being a family, and you know, our relationship transcended just like, you know, being, you know, business partners, or, you know, just even just playing, you know, like we were best friends. And I don't know, like one of the most devastating things that's ever happened to me. And it's kind of messed up. Like the 1 year anniversary, like a year has gone by, like the 1 year anniversary is coming up. And like, I am so sad that she is not here to be a part of this, because, you know, the show that we did in October, like she should have been there. That's something that she would have wanted. And you know, to have, I mean, she's in the documentary. The documentary was finished before she passed away, so she saw everything. You know, she was very pleased.
Did she help you work on it too?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. There's updated interviews there and everything like that. And, Trish actually did all the Indiegogo stuff for us too. Like she's a like graphic designer as well. And like, you know, super, super talented. So she was very much a part of, you know, creating this and making sure that it kind of went out the way that it did. And there's her updated interview in there is fantastic. And it's just,
yeah,
I just can't believe that, you know, I just cannot believe it.
Are you guys doing any kind of premiere for it? Or are you renting out like a theater or having like people will be able to come watch the documentary all together with you guys?
Well, we actually did October 27th. We did a friends and family premiere, which I was one of the Indiegogo perks. So anyone that paid for, you know, the chance to come to the friends and family event, we rented out a theater in London. We had like some photographers there. And then, you know, we had, you know, the press and everybody there. Showed the documentary to everyone, and then we walked down the street to the London Music Hall, and we played the 20th anniversary show, which everybody that's on the cover there, save for Trish, of course, was playing at the show. So we did, I guess, different lineups. We had the original lineup play. We had the, you know, Oracle Until the End lineup play.
Wow.
And we had the In the Black and I Failed You lineup play, so that we did three different sets, and then a tribute for Trish at the end.
What's that like for you? I mean, was it emotional? Was it just a lot of fun? Like, I'm sure a lot of those people you know you don't talk to every day, you know, or some of them you probably haven't talked to in many years. So what was that that experience like for you in general?
Honestly, it was like one of the best nights ever. You know, I had been organizing everything, pretty much just myself, you know, for the last number of months before the show. And so, you know, I was very stressed out. A lot was sort of riding on it, you know, arranging travel and making sure everybody, you know, was practiced and knew the set and knew what, sort of how everything was going to go down. But as soon as we got on stage, it's amazing that how it doesn't even matter how long it's been, the chemistry will always be there.
Right.
Like it was such a magical night. And I'm so glad that there were so many people that came from all over the world. Like people flew in from Australia, from Germany, like from South America to come to the show. It was so wild. And you know, getting to rock out with like Ivy and Tara again, and like the original lineup, Fallon and Tanya. Like we hadn't been on stage together in 18 years. So that was made me feel really old. but it's amazing.
After life, isn't that scary?
Yeah, totally. But the power and the magic is still there. So it's always, it's always an interesting thing that you just kind of fall right back into those grooves, regardless of the passage of time.
Wow. So what's going on next? I know, you know, you've got kind of like a day job, and Mercedes does as well. You guys aren't a full-time band at the moment.
No.
But when can the fans and everybody expect, you know, a new Kitty album, a tour, something else other than this documentary?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the documentary itself is sort of our presentation for the world.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to include the DVD and Blu-ray, and there's a live album. All the live stuff is sourced from different eras. So we've got stuff going all the way back to Ozfest 2000, that
wow.
sort of thing. So you're getting a live experience in a way that you know, most people wouldn't have had the luxury of experiencing it in that way. So, but it's hard to say. I mean, I think that the documentary hopefully will open some doors. I can't say that there will be like a full U.S. tour or anything like that. But I do think that, you know, an idea like the show that we did, in October is very real. It's potential. And we'll, you know, be doing a lot of, appearances, hopefully a few more premieres in places to at least, you know, have the documentary, seen, by an audience.
Yeah.
And we'll take it from there. I mean, I think it had been about 4 years since we had played a show, before this show in October. So we're sort of just getting our feet wet and testing the waters with, you know, what the reaction, I guess,
totally.
Is going to be and take it from there. But
totally.
I guess we'll see. Yeah.
Totally. And because this is a podcast, I know you have been dabbling in podcasting as well with your own podcast, the Witchfinger podcast, which I think is very cool.
Yeah.
It's kind of something that you started with a couple friends to talk about horror movies, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So it's basically an 80s horror podcast. So we only
Sick.
Watch the best of the worst. And we've been doing it for about 2 years now. Podcasts are, they're like fun. I don't know. It's like sitting in like a living
fun.
Room with a bunch of friends, right?
Sure.
Like, and essentially that's kind of what we were already doing when we were just hanging out. Like, let's, you know, have some drinks and watch a bad movie and just like laugh and like look up, you know, trivia on IMDb and just have a good time. And we always thought that we were really funny. So we're like, maybe other people will think we're funny too. And so far, you know, we have a pretty good audience.
Sure,
and
awesome.
We've been doing it for a couple of years now. And I think we have like 25, 26 episodes, something
nice.
Like that. And we watch all the 80s horror goodness. So
what's coming up on the list? Like, what are some ones that you really want to dive into, or can you not divulge that?
Oh no, we definitely can. I think our next episode will be Dolls.
Okay.
If you remember Dolls.
Yeah, I remember Dolls.
who doesn't? Like, that was one of those like horror section, like jumbo video, like,
oh man,
it's like one of the like covers that always popped out at you with that doll with her friggin' eyes popping out and stuff. Yeah, that's cool, right? So we're gonna be doing Dolls. That'll be our next episode. And the last episode that we did was House. We've done like Fright Night,
yeah,
all kinds of good stuff, really bad stuff and also really good stuff. So yeah, check it out, Witchfinger Horror Podcast.
Horror Podcast. I'm sure a lot of people will check it out because this is a podcast and people like podcasts.
For sure.
So
yes, not for the faint of heart though. We if you're interested in what, you know, girls really talk about when they're just hanging out, you should probably take a listen. We're a bit crass, I would say. It's rated R or above for sure.
Perfect. That makes it even better.
Well,
thank you so much for taking the time. I don't think I have anything else to talk to you about. We've covered so much ground, but I'm really excited to watch this documentary, as I'm sure a lot of other
people
are.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Morgan.
And have an awesome one.
All right. I'll see you around. Have a great night.
Cheers. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
So there it is with Morgan. What a great conversation. I just really enjoyed it. She was such a sweetheart. And it's really cool, like, going back and just thinking about how different, you know, the world was. And, you know, I had this
thought. I don't know if this is a stupid thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyways. You know, I remember growing up and in the early 90s, and, you know, there were bands like, you know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and, you know, those were the big bands at the time. And I remember thinking to myself, the older bands like, you know, Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and you know, even the Beatles, like, that those bands were so old and it was so long ago. And what's crazy is, in 1991, you know, it was only 20 years previously that Led Zeppelin had put out, you know, like, their third album. Like, Black Sabbath had put out, I think they were on their second album at the time. And that only been 20 years. So what's crazy now is to think that over 25 years has passed since Nirvana, you know, put out music. And that's my childhood. So what's crazy, and how this relates to Kitty, is you're talking about, what has it been, 20 years they have been a band, and how much has changed, and the way technology has changed, it's escalated far quickly than it had, you know, from 1970 to 1992, let's say, than from, you know, 2000 to 2018. So it is really, really crazy just to see how far it's come. So I cannot wait to watch this documentary. It comes out in March. Make sure you check it out. Make sure you pick it up. As always, I will leave you with a tune, and I know a lot of you guys know, you know, Brackish, and you know some of the earlier Kitty stuff, but I want to play a song that came out, you know, on their last kind of official album, just to show some of the progression. You know, I know I played Brackish over in the intro. I'm going to play a song called We Are the Lamb from their album I've Failed You, which came out in 2011. Check it out if you like what you hear, and make sure you pick up that DVD. Very, very, very cool stuff. Here it is. Kitty, Unleashing Your Syndrome. Peace and love. We'll see you next week.